Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, if you've read the New York Times over the past 25 years, you might recognize the name Frank Bruni. He's been a food critic, White House correspondent, and most recently, a columnist. One morning in 2017, he woke to discover he had gone functionally blind in one eye and was at risk of losing sight in the other. To cope with the changes in his life, he sought out the wisdom of others who had faced physical challenges and traumas. He recognized in them, and eventually in himself, an ability to accept, to overcome, and to adapt. He wrote about this journey in a new memoir, The Beauty of Dusk. He joined me last week to discuss confronting his own vulnerability and what it taught him about the limitations we all encounter and the lens through which we view them. Frank Bruni, describe what happened to you on that momentous day. You woke up and you knew something was wrong.
Yeah, it was October 2017, and I got out of bed and I wasn't seeing properly. There was a dappled fog over the right side of my field of vision. And of course, you don't immediately think, oh, something terrible has happened. I thought, oh, I got to clean my glasses, and I kept cleaning my glasses. Then I thought, maybe I just need to put some water in my eye. Maybe there's some kind of residue there. And that was my thinking for many hours, because I think our psychology as human beings is you don't immediately go to the worst thing. But nothing changed over the course of 24 hours. And by the next day, I was at the eye doctor. And several days after that, I was at a neuro-ophthalmologist, which is a different kind of specialist. And before a week was over, I had been told that I had had a stroke in my right optic nerve that had frazzled that optic nerve. I was told that I would almost certainly never see normally or well or functionally out of that eye again. And most terrifyingly, Diane, I was told initially wrongly that there was a 40% chance it would happen to my left eye. It turns out that the odds are more 15 to 20%. But I had to suddenly adjust to compromised vision and learn to live with the uncertainty of possibly going blind.
And then you went through some treatments that were not at all pleasant. They were experimental treatments, hoping that this would work.
Yes, I guess the word is fortunate. I was fortunate enough to qualify sequentially for the only two meaningful trials going on of possible treatments for what I have, which is called NAION. The first trial involved a series of three injections into the eye itself, and that was about as scary a thing as I've ever been through, but, and this is the point of the book, totally endurable. And then the second trial was 6 months of twice-weekly injections that I learned to administer to myself, but not into the eye, into the thigh or the stomach, kind of similar to what a woman taking hormones to try to help conceive goes through. But that too was pretty daunting. I lived with a Sharps container and these vials in my fridge and this stash of needles. But this is the real message of the book, Diane, as you know, we're all much stronger than we realize, and we're much more adaptable. And I went from someone, it must have taken me 20 minutes to give myself that first injection properly. Within a matter of weeks, I was preparing that syringe and giving myself the injection in like 45 seconds, and I'm back out the door. Because that's our ability as humans.
So after you heard you might lose your sight altogether, instead of staying at home and moping, as I did when I almost lost my voice completely, you started asking other people about their stories of some problem physical that overtook them. Why did you decide to do that?
Great question. I think it wasn't so much a decision, Diane, as it was a sort of reflex. You know, we're journalists. What we do for a living, what comes naturally and organically to us, is to ask the people around us to share their expertise with us, to ask them to share their wisdom. And I realized rather quickly that I was blessed in being a journalist, and I could turn what was happening to me into an investigation that would have meaning not just for me, but for other people as well. I didn't know initially that it was going to take the form of a book. And as you know, the book is as much about other people as about me. In the book, I am less teacher than I am student. And there are so many people around us who carry around pain and have figured out how to deal with it, all kinds of pain, who are the alumni of incredible struggle. And I think we fail in a silly way to avail ourselves of their wisdom. And I just think as a journalist, my natural instinct was to go to those people, ones I knew already, ones I was just meeting, and get their stories and their wisdom about how we go through these struggles and make the most of them.
I can understand how you might turn to people you already knew, but how did you find, and give me an example of someone you had never met before?
What I did was, as I moved through my days, when I encountered someone who said something, maybe it was an explicit thing, maybe it was just a verbal cue, that let me know that they were going through something tough or had been through something tough, I followed up. So a good example is I went for a long weekend to Las Vegas at one point, because please don't judge me, Diane, I actually have a soft spot for Las Vegas and for blackjack, and we won't go into that. And I went to a restaurant, I made the reservation under my name, and it turned out that someone, a manager in the restaurant, recognized that name as a Times writer and had read an essay that I had recently written for the Times about my compromised and imperiled eyesight. And he introduced himself to me. He thanked me for the essay, said it was very meaningful, and just made a very fleeting comment about his own lifelong struggles with his vision. Huh. Well, when I woke up the next morning, I thought, I want to follow up. And I called the restaurant and I said, can I get his name and his contact information? They gave it to me. I arranged to do several phone interviews with him. And he had this extremely inspiring story. He was born with a very serious vision disorder in Scotland. It made school tough. It meant he'd never been able to drive a car. But he decided, you know what, it's going to make me more determined to pursue my dreams. His dream was a career in the hospitality industry. He thought I should go to Vegas, the kind of capital of the hospitality industry. And he went to college at UNLV, graduated, and was making a significant career for himself in the hospitality industry. And we talked about how he made all that happen. We talked about how he adjusted to his disability. And that's all in the book. That's a good example of the kind of thing I did.
And there was someone else that you met whose name was Marion. Tell me about her.
Yeah, Marion Shepherd. She's an incredible, incredible woman. Marion, I happened to meet, as I was kind of educating myself on my own vision disorder and on vision disorders in general, I happened to meet a wonderful woman named Nancy Miller, who runs a kind of social services agency for vision impaired people called Visions. And I was just asking Nancy if she had any interesting stories, but people, blind people, people who are almost blind, who are doing things you wouldn't expect of them. And she said to me, and I remember it, she said, well, I have a blind dance instructor. And I thought, a blind dance instructor? I mean, it piqued my curiosity, but also felt to me like such a perfect illustration of the way we can transcend limitations and kind of move outside the categories people would assign for us. And Marion Shepherd went blind and spent a couple of months, years really kind of cowering at home, and then thought, I cannot continue doing this. And through a series of events, ended up teaching dance to blind people at the Blind Social Services Center. And I mean, we're not talking about elegant, acrobatic, we're not talking about the Bolshoi here, right? But we're talking about, you know, people who had created and found this safe space for themselves, where they could kind of move with freedom and joy. And that is a tough thing. And now I'm not anywhere near legally blind. I do very well with my one eye. But if you are legally blind, it can be difficult to find a space in life where you can physically move without any sort of reservation or self-consciousness or danger. And that's what Marion Shepherd created in this dance class in Lower Manhattan.
There's another woman you referred to whose name is Dory. Tell me about Dory.
Ah, Dory. I love Dory. Dory was one of my closest friends in college. And Dory was just pure sunshine, you know, beautiful, one of the biggest smiles I've ever seen. Just everybody loved Dory. She was just a force of nature and a force of joy in everyone's lives. And we kept in touch for a while after college, and then I lost track of her for many years. Not totally, but we, you know, maybe it was an email or a Facebook message every couple of years. And then she came to New York and asked to see me, and I met her for lunch. And what she told me then, but what I did not know, is that she had been diagnosed really early in life, much earlier than most people, with rather severe Parkinson's. And I could see that she was not in complete control of her facial movements. I could see that she was struggling physically. And but she was still, Diane, pressing on and leading a full life. And in that conversation and in subsequent ones, we sort of danced around her Parkinson's. But when this happened to me, I thought, Dory's a perfect example of one of those people who probably has a story to tell and wisdom to share, but I've never given her the opportunity. And so I emailed her and I said, Dory, I'd love to begin a conversation, you know, a written conversation about your Parkinson's, about what you've been through, about what you've learned, if you're game. And it probably will end up in a book and all of that. And Dory was game, and it was such a meaningful dialogue, which I hope I reproduce meaningfully in the book.
You know, it's so interesting because so many of us are reluctant to do exactly as you did. Say, tell me about your Parkinson's. My husband suffered and died of Parkinson's in 2014, and rarely would anybody other than me say, how are you feeling? What's going on? What kinds of indications did you have? People are reluctant, as though it's too personal to get into.
Yes, I think that's a really important observation. And I think it's an excess of courtesy. I don't think it's that people don't care. I think they don't want to be intrusive. I think they don't want to be downers. But I'm guessing, and you can tell me about your husband, those of us who've had these things happen to us, we certainly don't want to talk about them all the time. But I think we're more willing to talk about them, and we're more interested in being asked, how are you, than people realize or than people follow through on. So I try to be more intentional now when I meet someone who, when I have a friend or an acquaintance who's going through something, I try to be more intentional about saying, how are you? And then kind of looking very careful and seeing if the cue is, ask me more, I want to continue. Or if the cue is, no, I don't want to continue. But I want to give people that invitation and opportunity. Because I do think we're reluctant, and I don't think it's because we're callous. I think it's because we're excessively polite.
Another person whose story really stayed with you, Juan Jose, a career diplomat in Mexico City. Tell me about him.
Yeah, Juan Jose is someone I met soon after this happened to me through mutual friends. And I met him not because this has happened to me. It was sort of fated to be. Just it was, these were very good friends of mine who at some point were invariably going to put me and Juan Jose together in a dinner group. He is legally blind, has been since his early 30s as a result of retinitis pigmentosa. And he has nonetheless had a very high level career as a diplomat for the country of Mexico. Juan Jose had such an attitude, such an optimism. And he said to me, you know, I don't see my blindness as a disability. I see it as a characteristic. It is who I am, the way someone else is underweight or overweight or short or tall. And I thought that was such a healthy way to regard it. But the other thing that really stuck with me about Juan Jose is he was proud, right? So rather than being angry about the degree to which blindness had perhaps made things harder, given him challenges, rather than be self-pitying about it, he had decided to be proud about all the ways in which it had not, he had not let it limit his life, and all the ways in which he had transcended it. And as I listened to him talk about that, and as I watched him live such a full and joyous life, I thought the saying is kind of wrong. We say when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. Juan José was an example of when life gives you lemons, take a bow, right? because not only have you made lemonade, but your lemonade is good lemonade, and you're forging forward. And so that's the way Juan José really sticks with me.
Now a quick break. When we return, the rest of my conversation with Frank Bruni.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Frank Bruni of the New York Times. His new book is titled The Beauty of Dusk. Now, during the time you are going through all the testing, all the experimentation, you and your companion broke up. That must have been so hard on you.
It was it was, Diane, unideally timed. But yeah, I mean, it was a tough period, because not only was I dealing with compromised vision that made it harder to read, harder to write, not only was I dealing with the prospect of blindness, which still exists. I still have that sword dangling over me. But a 10-year relationship ended, and I felt very alone, obviously. My father has dementia, and that was getting worse and more complicated. So yeah, it was a crossroads of life where I was really feeling how tough things can be. But I would have thought, if you had sketched that out for me, Diane, and said, how are you going to react to it? I would have said to you, I'm probably going to be in bed in the fetal position, clutching a bottle of wine or a bottle of gin, and I'll probably remain there for a couple of years. But I didn't. And that's not because I am the least bit extraordinary. Trust me, I'm not. It's because we are all much stronger and more resilient than we realize. I think you can speak to that. And it gave me a sort of assurance and confidence as I move into the future, as I age. I think my book is in large measure about aging. And I think it's important for us not to make assumptions about what we can and can't handle and what we will and won't be able to go through. And then, of course, I did one really smart thing, which maybe you'll want to talk about because we share a love for these creatures. I got a dog, and it really was a good decision and an important thing, and it filled a big hole.
Very interesting to me just how you got that dog.
You mean my scheming, Diane?
Yes.
I knew my dog, Regan, who's wonderful. I knew her since she was a puppy. She belonged to my younger brother. And so I'd see her several times a year, and I would take her on hikes and stuff like that. My younger brother and his wife had become empty nesters, or were about to. They were doing a lot more travel, and so they were boarding or finding care arrangements for Regan much more often. And I saw an opportunity, and I said, hey, is that really the best life for Regan, or maybe should Regan be with me? And so I wheedled Regan 3 years ago from my younger brother when she was 5. She has lived with me now for 3 years. She's 8 now, and she is one of the real joys of my life.
What kind of a dog?
Regan came from a border collie rescue because they looked at her and made certain assumptions, but it turns out she has no border collie in her. I did a DNA test, as a lot of us dog mad people do, and the results came back that she was half Australian Shepherd. One of her parents was a purebred Australian Shepherd, apparently, and the rest of her was mostly Siberian Husky. And she's gorgeous. She's
but
black and
Frank,
white.
Frank, yeah. These are big dogs. You were at the time, I gather, living in an apartment, were you not?
I was living in an apartment in Manhattan, but I was a block from Central Park. And I just decided I am going to do right by this creature. And we spent pretty much an hour and a half to 2 hours every morning during off-leash hours in Central Park.
Wonderful. And she's still healthy and joyful and gives you a great deal of joy.
Absolutely. Just in North Carolina now.
I've always thought of you as a New Yorker. What prompted the decision to move to North Carolina?
I was ready, Diane, for something quieter and calmer. I was ready for a professional change of sorts. And so while I still write a weekly newsletter / column for the New York Times,
which I get.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm fond of my newsletter. It's no longer a full-time gig, and I spend the rest of my time teaching at Duke University. So I was just ready for a new professional challenge. I was ready for something different, quieter, calmer. You know, I like having trees and creeks and deer in my life.
Going back to your eyesight, how has the blindness in one eye affected your ability, or how have you adjusted to teaching with that one eye working?
Well, it affects teaching in the same way it affects my journalism, which is that when it comes to matters of reading and writing, I'm slower. I have to budget more time. I'm not as fleet as I used to be. In the sense of reading, it's just because I have to be much more careful about, you know, what format am I reading. You know, often I read ebooks so I can upsize the type, control the lighting. And even so, there's sometimes a weird thing that happens because one eye is trying to see and failing and the other eye is seeing. Sometimes words shimmy or swim a little bit. It's not terrible. It's manageable, but it slows me down. And with writing, I used to be the cleanest writer. And now, like, I will commit typos all over the place and I have to budget time to circle back and fix that. And that factors in. I mean, that makes both teaching and writing a little bit more cumbersome, but it's a matter of just understanding that at the outset, budgeting more time. I mean, I'm blessed. Somebody wants me to teach. Somebody wants me to write. People publish that writing. So if it takes me more time and effort, well, I'll deal with that.
You know, it's so interesting to me. I started wearing hearing aids about 3 years ago, and people would say to me, "Oh, you wear hearing aids?" As though that was a very definite sign of aging.
People
are embarrassed to wear hearing aids, but I wear glasses to read. Nobody's embarrassed about wearing glasses. But what do you think the difference is?
Well, I don't think there's a whole lot of logic to the things that we, you know, to these sorts of things we fear, these sorts of taboos or whatever. But I do think if you kind of look at statistics, hearing loss is very well correlated to aging. And I think people kind of viscerally or kind of instinctively, intuitively understand that. Whereas we're super aware of people who need corrective lenses, be they contacts or glasses, at an early point in life. Now, there are all sorts of serious vision disorders as opposed to just kind of eyesight that needs correction that are also aging correlated and that happen later. But it is a much more common phenomenon to see people using glasses at young ages than to see them using hearing aids at young ages. So I think that's why hearing aids have such an association connotation of, oh, now you're old. But people do sometimes freak out when they get bifocals, when they get graduated lenses, right? You know, that's the aging thing.
So how is your eyesight now?
My right eye is useless, but you can get by in life with one eye. I mean, to wit, in every state in the union, you can legally drive with vision out of just one eye. In some states, there are restrictions about nighttime driving, that sort of thing. But your brain, our ever nimble, ever plastic brains, can do a very good job of adjusting for the fact that you have monocular as opposed to binocular vision. and sort of compensating in a pretty good way to allow you some depth perception, that sort of thing. So my brain has gotten better and better in the almost 5 years since this happened at helping me see almost as well out of one eye as I did out of two eyes. But it's inconsistent. It's a kind of, it's not a clean arc. It's more of a jagged line. And there are days and moments and minutes when I have to kind of slow down and when I am having some trouble doing whatever I'm doing because my brain isn't doing a great job at that moment of adjusting for my bad eye.
Frank, during this early period, when the realization that this vision wasn't going to come back, no treatment was going to make it better, did you go through what probably many do, anger, rage, why me, before you got to the notion of, I'd like to find out how others deal with these issues?
I definitely did, Diane. I mean, at first, I think I was in a state of disbelief. And then there was a brief stage of exactly what you describe of, you know, some anger and definitely that question, why me? But in a way that, again, I'm a very fortunate person because we're all wired different ways. And I discovered I was wired in some ways that helped me. I realized that if I stayed in the stage of why me, the longer I stayed in that stage, the harder it was going to be to get out of it. The deeper a funk that I let myself descend into, the more distant the climb out of that funk. And I realized that unless I wanted to spend the rest of my life in an angry, sad, why me place, I better get past it fast. It's a kind of fork in the road. And it's a fork in the road that those of us who've had medical misfortunes early in life come upon earlier, but I think it's a real foreshadowing and foretaste of what everyone is going to encounter as they age. You're going to come upon forks because, as I write in the book, these bodies of ours are time bombs and each detonates in a different way. You're going to have that moment of detonation and you're going to come upon a fork, and I'm mixing metaphors wildly here, and I apologize for that, you know, where you're going to make a decision. Am I going to focus on what potency I still have, on what control I still have? Am I going to focus on what abilities remain or on the ones that have waned and been lost? And for most people, so much does remain that you can decide to focus on that. And that's how I steered myself.
The other wonderful idea you talk about in your book is the sandwich board theory. Tell us about that.
As part of this effort to say, to avoid why me, and to move to the much, much more truthful and realistic question, which is why not me, I started looking around and doing a sort of survey and tally of the challenges, the struggles that everyone around me had been through or were going through. And it occurred to me, just this kind of metaphor came into my mind, that if we all wore sandwich boards that just listed very briefly the main things we were struggling with at that moment or the biggest things that we had overcome in the recent or distant past, we would all realize that struggle and hardship are really less exceptional than they are the default human settings. And I think we would be much less prone to envy, much less susceptible to self-pity. And I think we would lead saner and happier lives in that regard. We would also be, I think, quicker to and more generous with empathy. Because I think too many of us go through life assuming that our struggles are singular or that we've been dealt a more difficult hand. And most often that's not true, and it's certainly not constructive.
You know, I find myself wondering if you were writing a Sunday column, what would you be saying about Ukraine and Vladimir Putin?
Well, there are two things that that have been on my mind, and I in fact did write about one of them in a newsletter last week, and we're talking here. I have a newsletter coming out in an hour or two that focuses on the other. And what I did write recently was we all forget that what's going on is consistent with all history and not exceptional. There was this sense of disbelief and shock when Putin seemed to be poised to invade Ukraine. And when he did, like, how can this be happening? And sort of as we were talking about why me versus why not me, the question is really, how can this not be happening? Because we should not be shocked. Human nature does not change through history. There are advances we make. There are advances we have made in recent history. There's a way in which we try and sometimes make steps towards the perfection of human civilization. But things like all of the emotions that seized Vladimir Putin, all of the aggression, the paranoia, et cetera, that leads to this kind of thing, those are human failings that transcend time. And so I think we have to understand that what's happening now, as horrific as it is always a possibility and always a threat. And in fact, happens all the time in other regions of the world. And there's no reason that Europe should be immune to it or that the United States should be immune to it. That's one thing I think about. The other thing I'm thinking about right now, because Joe Biden just gave the State of the Union, is it's really striking to me that no president gets the presidency he expects. So Joe Biden knew that he was in for the most challenging of rides. He knew that, you know, the pandemic was pressing on our economy and many people's financial health had been devastated by that. He knew that he was inheriting a situation of just crazy polarization and partisanship. He knew all of that, and yet he had no idea that his biggest nightmare, his most pressing challenge, was going to be a war, a land war in Europe. And it's a kind of lesson to any candidate, but it's a lesson also to voters that we need to always be careful. And I'm not saying we didn't do so in this case, but we should never be choosing and electing presidents for the moment. We should be choosing and electing presidents for any moment, because the moment changes, as I just recently wrote, in the blink of an autocrat's ego.
Do you have any thoughts about where this could be going?
I have no thoughts about where this could be going, and that's why I feel a real humility when a kind of assessing our government and Joe Biden's response about all this, because none of us have a crystal ball and he doesn't. And so I, like you and everyone else, am just sort of watching and hoping for the best and saying whatever version of a prayer a person says.
Finally, Frank, tell me about the title of your book, which is so lovely, The Beauty of Dusk.
Thank you. I'm really proud of the title. I don't think I've ever written a book that I felt as good about the title as about The Beauty of Dusk, or the cover. I also have a really pretty blue cover, which I love. The Beauty of Dusk, I mean, dusk is serving double duty as a metaphor. I mean, partly it is an oblique reference to the diminished clarity of my sight, to the fact that there isn't less light, but that things are not as bright and illuminated as they once were. But it's also really about the kind of the span of the day as a metaphor for the human life. We tend to fear physical diminishment. We tend to fear aging. And the book is about the silver linings and the upsides to all of that. So that's part of what The Beauty of Dusk means.
It truly is beautiful. And I'm glad you chose that title. Congratulations on the book, Frank. And I pray for you that this does not go to the other eye. But God forbid if it does, I know you'll get through it.
Thank you, Diane. I thank you for your warm wishes and for that and for your vote of confidence. And I thank you for your time. Really appreciate it so much.
And yours. Thank you. That was Frank Bruni, contributing opinion writer at the New York Times and author of The Beauty of Dusk, on Vision, Lost and Found. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. Thanks for listening, all. Be well, stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.